It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It's a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. So we enter this time of centering and prayer and silence, and it's a time for us to come to find and rest in our own center. You may use these first few moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just by sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. The prayer this morning is adapted from Prayer Before Birth by Lewis McNeese. Now please join me in a spirit of prayer. I am not yet born, oh hear me. I am your tomorrows, but I am not yet born. I am not yet born, console me. Protect me from the doubts that strangle, the fears that stifle, the friends who drain and demean. I am not yet born. Give me dreams of what we may yet become and nourish me, that I do not starve before I gain the strength to walk and to fly and perhaps even to soar with the eagles. I am not yet born. Oh, hear me. Protect me from those who can remain big only by keeping those around them small. For I am yet a fragile thing. I'm not yet born. Fill me with strength against those who would freeze my humanity, who would make me into a thing, who would dissuade and drain me until I lose my spirit, and then my soul, and then my hope. And your hope as well, for I am the greater you who is not yet born. And together we must strive with the gods if necessary, for so much is at stake. There is so much to be gained. I am the you who is yet to become, and I am not yet born. Help me. Part of what I want to do in this morning's sermons is bridge the gap between the responsive reading we had and the hymn we just sang. The responsive reading we have is absolutely soaked in and grew from our Western culture and our biases, where it simply assumed, as Waldemar Argau assumed, that to talk about religion is to talk about God, not any God, but this one from the Bible. The hymn we just sang is talking about how all of our allegiances and identities are quite local, though people elsewhere have the same kinds of feelings we do. It's that same kinds of feelings from elsewhere that I want to try to get in touch with in the sermon today. I've promised the keynote speakers that I won't talk about anything that's happened in the last 1,800 years. So they have lots of room to talk about modern things. I want to talk about the ancient roots of the spirit of liberal religion. It is as old as the oldest story in history. It isn't a new thing. It is as deep as anything in humanity. The soul of it, even professors of religion often teach that liberal theology, and that's what I was taught, that liberal theology actually began in the very late 18th century through the work of the great German theologian Friedrich Schleiermacher, and he was a great theologian, and he did begin in some sense the modern practice of liberal theology, but even Schleiermacher, as he well knew, was a latecomer. The spirit of liberal religion which is opposed to the spirit of literal religion. Change one letter, you change an entire world of possibilities. It's at least 4,000 years old. It's not at all new. It had many births in many places. And I want to talk about some of those births this morning, because they're things we don't talk about as much. First, it was born in the world's oldest story, the still magnificently modern story of Gilgamesh, a story that I think we should read more often. He was a real person. He ruled about 4,700 years ago. And the earliest texts of the story are from 4,100 years ago, before any of today's great religions or their gods had been born. They saw themselves, and this sounds odd, they saw themselves as living in the modern age, and they spoke of themselves as moderns. And it sounds so odd for us to think of anyone born before, 1930. Actually, to think that they were modern, you wonder what they meant by it. But what they meant by it is very interesting. That's where writing had first been invented 100 years earlier. And so they saw themselves as separated from all these primitive oral people before them who had no writing. They really did see a dividing line in history that came right where they lived, just 100 years before they lived, in the memories of some of their parents and grandparents. And as moderns, they wanted to revisit all the eternal questions all these ancient, non-modern people had been asking. And one of the questions they wanted to revisit was, what use are the old gods to us modern people? That's a very modern question from 4,700 years ago. What they decided was that the gods had become impotent ornaments. I'll tell you a little more about the story. Usually the only thing anybody learns about Gilgamesh is that this was the source of the Noah and the Ark story from the Hebrew Scriptures. And it's true that they had Utnapishtim and his wife, who the gods told to build an ark and put animals on it and so on for this. But when Gilgamesh was trying to figure out what use the gods are, he thought, well, the only use they've ever been is that they can let people live forever, although I haven't heard about that lately. So when was the last time they did this? And someone said, well, they did it with the Noah guy. They did it with him. And so he hunted him down, and sure enough, here's old Utnapishtim and his wife, very old Utnapishtim and his wife. And Gilgamesh says, how did this work, this thing with the gods and the eternal life and all that? It sounds wonderful. How did it work? And Utnapishtim says, it's not wonderful. Said, but that was the deal. We were told to make the boat and put the animals on it, and so my wife and I got to live forever. He said, but it's not wonderful. And he said, my God, everyone I've ever known is dead. All my children are dead. All my grandchildren are dead. Their grandchildren are dead. He said, I have no peers. I have no contemporaries. It's just the two of us like this forever. So I thought, well, that doesn't sound too exciting, but it's still a long time, and that's a good thing. So he said, how do I get this done? He said, no, you don't understand. That was a one-time deal. He said, they're not doing that anymore. We were the last ones. So then he said, and see how modern this sounds. Well, all right, if I can't get eternal life through the gods, can I do it through drugs? Are there some drugs I can take to do this? How modern is that? And immediately, Merck and five other large pharmaceutical companies... And old Noah said, yeah, actually you can. There is a drug you can use. It's this plant, this magic plant that grows at the bottom of this lake. And, you know, if you can get that, eat that plant, you'll live forever. But, you know, this is kind of a one-time thing, too. So see if you can do it. And so he went out in his boat, and he got the plant, by gosh, and puts it in the boat, and he thinks, all right, I'll do it with drugs. The gods aren't useful, but I'll do it with drugs. But as you can see coming, a snake got the plant. And that's why snakes now get to shed their skin, live forever, and so on, and we don't. So there's no chance for this. So Gilgamesh was in some despair, and he's saying, If the old gods are useless, if not even pharmaceuticals can save us, what's the point of life? This is 4,700 years ago. What's the point of life? Is it just meaningless if it's just here and now? And then he said, no, it's not. The point of life is up to us, and it is all around us. It's in being able to make things and do things. It's in being able to love and have friends and be joyful, to sing and to dance and to make art and to make statues and to build walls around cities. That's what he was most famous for. This is the purpose of life, and it has nothing to do with gods or drugs. It's within us and among us. I think in some ways that story was more courageous and more unfettered than any Western religion. And it is the profound liberal spirit being born, one that will question anything and that wants to say, here in this life, what really works best. Now, as writing both evolved and spread, other people saw themselves as living in modern times. And if they traveled enough to learn about other cultures, they could now relativize their own culture and realize, you know, this is what we've been taught, but this other people believe other things, like the words in the hymn said. You know how the liberal spirit of deeds, not creeds, was born in the Hebrew prophets. But I want to talk about some of the traditions that you may not know as well, because we tend to be quite provincial and think that all religious talk must be some kind of variation on a biblical theme. But the liberal spirit was born before the Bible or the Hebrews had even existed. So I want to talk about the ancient parts. It was born at least twice in China. First in Confucius, who was concerned not with gods, but with ourselves here and now. And what he was concerned with about ourselves was that he said, we think of ourselves in far too small a set of terms. He said, we think of ourselves just as me. And he said, that isn't enough. He said, we're only our fullest selves when we're connected with the world around us and the society around us. That's our true selves. Now, there's a story about this that I've loved. I'm actually throwing it in partly because I wanted you to be able to leave here and say, you are not going to believe this. I was in a Unitarian church, and this guy actually talked about 13th century Neo-Confucianism. Who does that? So that's where the story comes from. And it's a story about this kind of transcendence. Confucians are very, very, very this worldly. They're non-supernatural. They don't like superstitious, magical stuff. They're a lot like our secular humanists. And so when the master one day said, well, today said, I'm going to be talking to you about magic, the students got very angry. They were very polite, but they were very angry. And finally, one of the students said, Master, this is not a word we respect. This is not a word that we think is the sort of thing we should be talking about. This is not a word that we think is real or has anything to do with the world. And could you be so kind, Master, as to explain this offensive word, magic? And the Master, like all good dramatic teachers, sighed. He said, well, I can do this, he said, but this is going to take some time. And he asked one student in the front, he said, would you get me a glass of water? And so the student got him some big glass of water, and he came back and he drank. And he set the glass down and he said, that was magic. He did my bidding without coercion, without threats, without bribes. He did my bidding simply because I asked him to and he wanted to. And the reason he wanted to was because we had established an atmosphere of trust and respect. That's the magic that makes our world run smoothly. That's the magic we need to learn. profound stuff. It was also born in Lao Tzu, the author of the Tao Te Ching. This is also the spirit of deeds, not creeds. The difference between being religious and yammering about religion is that in the yammering, we think it's about beliefs. When you get to all the good religious teachers, Hebrew prophets are very, very clear on this. Nobody cares what we believe. It's about behaviors. What are you doing? How are you acting? That's what all these are concerned with. Lao Tzu wrote what I think is one of the finest moral teachings in history from any religious or philosophical tradition in just five lines. What is a good man but a bad man's teacher? What is a bad man but a good man's job? If you don't understand this, you'll get lost, however intelligent you are. It is the great secret. Why is this the spirit of liberal religion or simply the spirit of honest religion? Because it links us to something eternal without insulting our intelligence or confining us to the biases of any one religion. Its insights transcend theology. They resonate in the hearts and the heads of all people. And because it isn't just poetry to feel good and wash over us, it commands us. That's what makes it so profoundly religious. Here's some other quotations, just a few from the Tao Te Ching. See how liberal and how modern they sound and feel. You'll hear some that could have been written this week. Must you value what others value and avoid what others avoid? How ridiculous. The great way is easy, yet people prefer the side paths. Sounds like Jesus with the way is narrow, or Hinduism or Islam that talk about the narrow way as the knife edge of a sword over an abyss. Be aware when things are out of balance. Stay centered within the Tao. When rich speculators prosper while farmers lose their land, when government officials spend money on weapons instead of cures, when the upper class is extravagant and irresponsible while the poor have nowhere to turn, all this is robbery and chaos. Could have been written this week. Let the Tao be present in your life and you will become genuine. Let it be present in your family and your family will flourish. Let it be present in your country and your country will be an example to all countries in the world. Let it be present in the universe, and the universe will sing. How do I know this is true? By looking inside myself. There's the whole circle. I think page for page, the Tao Te Ching is probably the wisest book ever written. Then we can go to the Greeks, some of my very favorites. They also did their thinking about life without gods after the Olympian period in the Golden Age. Xenophanes, wonderful, was born almost 2,600 years ago, before the Hebrew prophets. He criticized the religious literalism of his day in words that sound not only absolutely modern, but absolutely psychological. He'd traveled a lot, he'd seen a lot of cultures and religions, and he noticed the psychological projection going on in all religions. Here's some of what he said 2,500 years ago. He said, "People suppose that gods are born, wear their own clothes, and have a voice and a body. Ethiopians say that their gods are snub-nosed and black. Thracians say theirs are blue-eyed and red-haired." And then he added that if horses and oxen had hands and could draw pictures, their gods would look remarkably like horses and oxen. And then there's Socrates, the giant of Western thought in so many ways. It's hard to imagine the effect this man had on people. We know that at the end of his life he was condemned to death because he kept asking disturbing questions which were more profound than his society's provisional answers. So he obviously had an effect on people. But what would it have been like to interact with this man? We have, luckily, eyewitness testimony to this, and some of it's worth sharing. It's from Alcibiades, who said that Socrates' questions bite the heart like a viper and provoke in the soul a state of philosophical possession, delirium, and drunkenness. He said, "I was in such a state that it did not seem possible to live while behaving as I was behaving. He forces me to admit to myself that I do not take care for myself." That's what religious prophets do. Though few in history maybe have done it as well as Socrates. He believed that an innate desire for good exists in all human beings. Now here is a profound and specific assertion about why we have inherent worth and dignity, at least if we'll let that deep awareness command us. There's always that catch. Socrates described himself not as a philosopher, not as a sage, not as a teacher, but as a midwife. He said his job was helping to give birth to the greater possibilities he believed dwelled within us, waiting to be called forth. For all the Greeks, humans suffer because we are ignorant. Ignorance is the cardinal sin. Same as in Buddhism. Even for Epicureans who've had bad press as partygoers. Well, some people think that's bad press. But who really believe that we should be equally happy with simple pleasures as we are with extravagant ones. Even the Epicureans were taught always to act as though Epicurus were watching them. That's transcendence. This was echoed a few centuries later by the Romans, who taught that we should live under the gaze of eternity. One of my favorite phrases. It meant to live as though all the noblest people who had ever lived or ever would live were watching you, and then do only what you would do in front of that audience. It's hard to improve on that. Another liberal thinker named Plotinus, a few hundred years later, used a wonderful metaphor that I included just because it's worth sharing, to talk about how we should form ourselves. He used the metaphor of sculpture. He said, "If you do not see your own beauty yet, do as the sculptor does with a statue which must become beautiful. He pares away this part, scratches that other part, makes one place smooth and cleans another until he causes a beautiful face to appear in the statue. In the same way, you too must pare away what is superfluous, straighten what is crooked, purify all that is dark in order to make it gleam. And never cease sculpting your own statue until the divine light of virtue shines within you." Probably my own favorite spiritual and psychological center came through the Paideia culture of ancient Greece, 2,400 years ago. You may not know that odd word, Paideia. It's maybe the first time you've ever heard such a bizarre sound. But you do know its ideals, and you really do know what it's about. You just know it by another name. The Greeks believed that the best kind of humans were partly born, breeding matter. After all of their mythic heroes were born of a human and a god, same formula that the early Christians used. So breeding mattered. But they also believed that we're partly made. And the way you make noble humans is to shape them in the form of the highest ideals you can articulate. That meant for the Greeks the most sacred treasure in their culture were those collective high ideals, because it's how we make the best kind of people. And the collective noun for the highest ideals of a culture was paideia. They had it in the root of their words for both children and education. It was that fundamental. And it's still in the root of some of our words for children and education, as in pediatrics and pedagogy. Mortimer Adler, some of you know, started a paideia project that never caught on too well, though there is a paideia school in Austin. But this is salvation by character. This is saying we're saved by how nuanced, how deep, how noble we can become, and we become that way by letting ourselves be infused with and commanded by the noblest ideals in the culture and nothing less. Now, You still haven't heard of Paideia. When the Roman Cicero read about this stuff, he realized they didn't have either even the concept in Roman culture for this, and he liked it. So he coined a word to translate Paideia into Latin. And the word he coined was a perfect translation. The word he coined was humanitas, which really means the essence of what it means to be most fully human. This is the source of all of the liberal humanities education in Western civilization. These courses now being taken out of our educational system that were used to help us become more fully human and more fully divine to get to that point where they blend as they blended in the mythic Greek heroes. It's wonderful. The spirit of liberal religion was also born twice, at least, in India, in Hinduism and Buddhism. I want to share just a few quotes from the Upanishads, because it's probably not a book you've read in the last 3 weeks. Things written between 2,200 and 2,500 years ago, anonymously. They talked about Brahman, and that gets translated often as God, but Brahman was not a god. Brahman was the whole combination of the creative, sustaining, and destructive forces in the universe. Everything that makes everything move in the universe. And their formula was, we're part of that. That's part of us. So I've substituted this phrase to make it more clear instead of talking about Brahman. Know that the creative power of the universe is forever a part of you, and there's nothing higher to be known. It's found in the soul when sought with truth and self-sacrifice, just as fire is found in wood or water in hidden springs or cream in milk. If you deny this power, you deny yourself. If you affirm it, you affirm yourself. That statement is so close to one attributed to Jesus in the Gospel of Thomas, one of my very favorites from the Gospel of Thomas, where he says, and Carl Jung could have written this too, if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. That's about as existential and profound as it gets. And this image of a sword edge over an abyss comes to mind. A final thought from the Upanishads, which may strike you as it struck many others, as profoundly happier than most religious teachings. The creative power of the universe is joy. For from joy all things have come, by joy they all live, and unto joy they all return. It's lovely poetry, but it's so much more than poetry. The Hindu and Buddhist notion of karma is a lot like Socrates' notion of how our lives take the shape of the ideals we are serving, how we become what we worship. If we do good, we become good. If we serve shallow things, we become shallow people. If we do evil, we become evil. You feel how close this is to the Greeks. One of the great Greek sayings that attributed to Aristotle, but it probably is much older, where he said, plant a thought, reap a deed, plant a deed, reap a habit, plant a character, reap a destiny. What's liberal about this? It puts the ball in our court. It puts the power in our court. And it says, everything about your life is at stake here. St. Paul used to say, we work out our salvation in fear and trembling. Without the fear and trembling, we don't have a living religion with the power to get our attention to wake us up and to help steer us on this. This is existential religion. How modern is this? Now, one paragraph about Buddhism. This quick romp through great religions is not meant to be flippant. It's meant to be flying over a lot of territory to show that the patterns are profoundly similar and profoundly liberal and empowering, and sometimes very, very demanding, as they should be. the Buddha grew out of and he grew away from Hinduism, he taught that we just need to wake up. And what we need to wake up from are the illusions we've created through our language, through our teaching, through our ways of living, through our religious instructions, through our political ideologies. These are the things we live in. And he said, these are the illusions that you think give you life, and what they do is trap you in this bubble of an illusion. We need to wake up. And when we wake up, life won't be perfect, and it won't be as dramatic either. It'll be more like chopping wood and carrying water and entering into that. Every one of these ancient religions and philosophies is concerned with how to live, how to become the person we can be most proud of having been. And every one of them finds the power to do this within us, rather than through pleading for it or through conforming to someone else's creeds or beliefs. All of them believe we have to tune ourselves to a higher frequency, align ourselves with an enduring or internal order, serve others, see ourselves as small parts in a much larger reality. But the power to do this was always within us. The ball was always in our court. We were not missing pieces. We were not missing parts. We were born as a mix of good and evil. But our basic sin is simply ignorance of what we need to know. The gods won't do it for us. We're not saved or made whole through believing this or that, only through being. Maybe the best that preachers and churches can do is to aspire to the role of Socrates, to be midwives, and help us give birth to the greater possibilities within us, and to do it, as Alcibiades testified, whether people like it or not. The soul of the liberal spirit is about waking up. It's about waking from dogmatic slumbers, but also waking from lethargic slumbers that don't or won't dig beneath the surface and work harder. The waking up is an individual calling. It's the birth of our individual soul from the globular mass of our class, our social identity, our political or sexual or racial identity. It's to ask who we are, individually, personally, really, beneath all the other important but secondary influences that shape us and misshape us. You can feel the power of these things, whether they're from 4,100 years ago or from yesterday. They've always had that power of birthing our better selves once they grab hold of us to wake us up. We await and yearn for that kind of birth, that level of being born again, born of the Holy Spirit. How can it happen? We can only hope, some people might say. But Socrates and the rest of our liberal predecessors wouldn't buy that, and neither should we. Perhaps we can only hope, but not only hope. Not only hope.